Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, February the 10th. Just a quick update on the music. That's my good friend Brady Mosher, who is a guitar player here in Dallas. And I went to see him a couple of weeks ago, and he has a brand new CD. So I said, hey, give me some samples, and we'll mix your music with my other good friend Carlos. He and Carlos play together on Saturday night, so we'll be playing both. He's just a great guitar player, very talented. And I keep trying to figure out, what does this sound like? You know, what does Brady sound like? He seems to have a combination of a lot of different musicians. So congratulations to my friend Brady on the new album. And we're going to try to play his music as much as we can. Tonight we're going to talk about the Battle of Midway with our friend Barry Jacobson. We're going to get into this rather amazing turning point in World War II. I've got a few questions that I'm going to ask Barry to go over with, as well as many of the other things that he's going to bring up. But I kind of like to learn a little bit. We did this the last time, but learn a little bit about some of the events leading up to the battle. I want to talk a little bit about the U.S. Navy at the time versus the Japan Navy. These were two navies that months before had been involved in a huge battle that went more the Japanese way, to say the least. I'm talking about Pearl Harbor. I'd like to know a little bit about the air power that the two countries had, and then maybe the psychological impact before the battle and after the battle for both countries. So let me say hello to Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am well, Silvio. How are you?
Absolutely great. What do you think of a little music at the top there, my friend Brady here in town?
Well, it's peppy, shall we say.
It's peppy, and that's what...
Yes, it puts a little pep in your step.
What did it remind you of anybody?
Should it?
No, I'm trying to figure out what kind of style it is. I'm going to see Brady in a couple of weeks, and I kept thinking maybe there were some Eagles in it, do you think? Maybe some of their instrumental pieces? Some of their, not instrumentals, but some of their arrangements? I don't know. It just sounds, I'm intrigued,
either.
You know, by what it sounds like. Well, I'll keep you posted.
Please do.
I'll keep you posted. It's a great curiosity of mine. Well, tonight we're going to talk about the Battle of Midway. And this is, as you told us the last time, this was a turning point in the war. And what if you were explaining the Battle of Midway, let's say to someone who was not familiar with World War II, would you call it a turning point as I did, Barry?
No, in fact, I call it the turning point. Up until the Battle of Midway, which takes place in the very beginning of June of 1942, the Japanese have been running wild throughout the Pacific Ocean. They've had almost an unmitigated string of victories stretching from the Philippine Islands into Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore. They had fought us in the first battle in which but ships didn't even see each other in battle, the Battle of the Coral Sea in May of 42, just the month before Midway, and had actually sunk the USS Lexington, one of our only four carriers we had in the entire Pacific. So, it was a turning point in the sense that before that, Japan was on the offensive, and Roosevelt's strategy, of course, in World War II was Germany first. It was to aid the British and the Russians in knocking out Hitler before he really concentrated everything he had on Japan. But that was predicated on stopping the Japanese offensive. And the Japanese succeeded at Midway and then gone on to take Hawaii. They could have menaced the West Coast, and we would have had to, at the very least, divert a lot of our attention to defending our own shores. So in that sense, we'll talk more about the battle in a minute, but in that sense, yes, it was completely decisive. From then on, Japan was beaten in all but name. They didn't know it. It would take another 3 years of bloody war. Japan would have to be nuked literally twice before they admit that they had lost. But they lost the initiative, and because they lost that battle, war was all but over.
Interesting. Well, why don't you take us from the beginning? I had put some questions on the table that we can address during the course of the show. But why don't you begin with the events leading up to Midway?
Well, we already got into some of them. The Japanese had won the Battle of the Coral Sea, more or less. It was considered a draw, but they had sunk one of our four carriers, which is a victory in itself. See, after Pearl Harbor, the United States only had Task Force 16 and Task Force 17. And these were commanded by Admirals Fletcher and Admiral Spruance, with the overall, actually, originally it was Halsey, and then Halsey was replaced by Spruance just before the Battle of Midway due to an illness. But these four carriers divided equally into two task forces were all we had. If you remember, most of our battleships were at the bottom of Pearl Harbor. Reclamation was still undergoing, still underway in June of 1942. We had struck back with the Doolittle Raid, as you know. We talked about that last time, which was a pinprick attack, a flea bite. But it annoyed the Japanese, and it led Admiral Yamamoto, who was the commander of the combined Japanese fleet. That was the main Japanese attack fleet, much larger than anything we had. Just give an idea how much larger. They had 80-some ships at the Battle of Midway to our 28, of which only four of our ships were capital ships. They had seven battleships and six aircraft carriers. So they had a considerably larger fleet, superior in every imaginable way. And their plan was to steam across the Central Pacific, and with diversionary attacks in the Aleutian Islands, which they invaded a day before the Battle of Midway, the combined fleet would rendezvous with various elements 500 miles west of Midway Island, which is itself about 1,000 miles northwest of Hawaii. And it was an elaborate plan to try to draw the Americans into a battle away from Hawaii, because we had a lot of ground-based aircraft in Hawaii that could aid in a naval battle. So the Japanese wanted to lower our ships, three aircraft carriers, because, again, we lost the Lexington, so three aircraft carriers, into a battle we couldn't win, a battle up by Midway Island. And the plan was to attack Midway with an aircraft carrier task force that would spearhead the overall Japanese attack. This task force was commanded by Admiral Nagumo. And four of those carriers that made up that task force were four of the six that attacked Pearl Harbor. So these are the very same gentlemen, very same ships that attacked us on Pearl Harbor. Again, only about 7 months earlier. So the idea was they'd bomb Midway Island, and that would draw our aircraft carriers north to defend it, as well as the attack on the Aleutian Islands, which might also draw us out of Hawaii. And then they could attack our three aircraft carriers in an ambush off Midway. That was their plan. The second part of their plan was, once we attacked their carriers, the carriers with 10 hours in place with an air battle at sea, and then Admiral Yamamoto, their main commander, would bring up the rest of the fleet, which included all the battleships, and they'd close the gun range and just pulverize our aircraft carriers. So that was the plan. And it might have worked. Admiral Yamamoto was a brilliant strategist, maybe a little bit overcomplicated in his plans, but a brilliant strategist. The problem was, we had cracked the Japanese code. A naval commander in Pearl Harbor Naval Intelligence named Rochefort had broken most of the Japanese code. It was a very complex code, and we didn't have all the pieces. But in May, we had figured out most of their plan, but weren't sure exactly what the target was, because we didn't know what the code name for Midway Island was. Commander Rochefort suspected the initials AJ AF meant Midway Island, but he wasn't sure. So he planned a ruse. Now, it was a very clever ruse. What he did is he arranged for Midway Island to send a uncoded message back to Pearl Harbor requesting a water tanker be sent there to reprovision them with water because Midway doesn't have a natural source of water. A couple days later, on May 12, 1942, we intercepted a Japanese coded message, and when we broke the message, the one part we were missing was there because the message said, AF needs water. In other words, Midway Island needs water. Thus, we knew that AF in the Japanese complex code meant Midway Island. So at that point, we knew from all the other messages we got that Midway was going to be the target.
Let me ask you a very quick question about that. You being a military historian as well as a veteran yourself of the military, how easy or how often does one country break the code, if that's the right way to put it, of another country? I mean, I would think both sides, you know, it's sort of like the hunter and the prey, you know, I mean, they're kind of like, you know, constantly, it's like, I guess, you know, in a baseball game, they're constantly changing signals, as you know, because they don't want the signal stolen. So how lucky were we to be able to break the code? Or was it just that we were that good, Barry?
We were that good. The British, of course, broke the German code machine Enigma. They first captured one and then were able to break it. But we had the best code breakers in the war, the Allies did. Far better than the Axis for whatever reason. Better mathematicians, I don't know. I mean, the Germans are famously good at math, so I don't know. But we did break the Japanese code. We broke the German code. You know, in modern times, the KGB was frequently breaking our codes during the Cold War. We occasionally break theirs. When I was in the Army, we used a special method called a one-time code book, which basically every day the code changed. It was a book that had one page per day. So every day you'd use that particular page, which transposed in numbers and letters with other numbers and letters. And the only way you could tell which number meant what is to have the appropriate page. So if you captured, if you broke that code, it was only good for one day. So you had to put pretty darn fast if you're intercepting our codes, because the next day that whole set of ciphers would be different. That makes it pretty much impossible to break military codes today, because, again, they're always changing. That said, a high-speed supercomputer might be able to do it in 24 hours, but what would be the point? You know, you'd be constantly one day behind. But in the old days, Japanese and Germans were using a coded machine which used the same codes constantly. It's very difficult to break, but once we broke it, we had it. That's one of the reasons, by the way, we're going to talk about the Battle of Kursk later, and one of the reasons the Russians were completely ready for the German attack on Kursk in 1943 was because they had broke the German codes and, in fact, had spies in Berlin.
Yeah. One of these days, we need to do a show, after we're through with the World War II series, I'd like to do a show on this topic of military codes and some examples over the years of countries breaking code. I'm just fascinated by the whole thing. I hadn't thought that much about it. It's just fascinating. So one of these days, let's do a show about that, and you can tell us more about other examples throughout history of one nation, you know, basically breaking the code of another nation, Barry. It's just a little thing. I'm fascinated. Maybe we'll get to it sometime in the future.
It sounds good. It sounds like an interesting topic. And, of course, when we get back into the European theater in the coming weeks, we'll be talking about Enigma and how we broke the Enigma code.
Great.
Against Hitler.
Great.
So anyway, let's get back to Midway. So the Japanese fleet was steaming across the Pacific. We knew where they were coming. And we were able to lay what you think of as a counter-ambush. They had planned to lure us out of Hawaii and then ambush as we came towards Midway. But what they didn't know is we left Midway well before they got there with their screen of submarines. We were supposed to watch Hawaii and let them know when our carriers sortied forth. But instead, we left early because we knew they were coming. And our ships, actually, our three carriers, the Yorktown, the Enterprise, and the – what was the other one? The I'll think of it in just a second. But anyway, the three carriers were positioned just off of just north of Midway Island. About 500 miles waiting for the Japanese to show up. So Hornet, that was the one, I'm sorry, the Hornet. So the Hornet, which launched the Doolittle raid, by the way, the Yorktown and the Enterprise, each had about 100 planes. The Japanese had about 90 planes, each of their carriers. On June 4th, the Japanese move into position. And on June 4th, the battle begins with them bombing Midway Island. Air raid sirens go off in Midway Island. Our planes sortie up to meet them, but the Japanese manage to penetrate and take zero casualties in the process and just bomb the snot out of Midway Island. Meanwhile, we're looking for their ships. And the ocean is a big place, and this is before modern radar. Now, even though American carriers had radar, the air radar wasn't in the air where it can look down and see a very long range like modern-day aircraft radar does. Being on surface level, it only had a range of about 100 miles, so we didn't see the Japanese ships. Instead, we had to fan out with PBYs, scout planes, and look for the Japanese. And, of course, you're up in the air, and there's cloud cover, and it's, you know, it's a big ocean. So in some ways, it was a miracle we even found them in time. We knew they were approximately so many hundreds of miles, about 200 miles off of Midway based on the range of their planes. In fact, they were bombing Midway. But we didn't know exactly where they were. And then it happened. We spotted their fleet at about 7:30 in the morning. And Admiral Fletcher was in command. Admiral Spruance was in command. He again had replaced Bull Halsey. Was sick due to illness. He was on board the Enterprise. And he ordered a sortie, basically a sortie of all three planes, all three carriers. The problem was there was lots of problems with the launch, and it was not a coordinated launch. In fact, Yorktown's planes launched a good hour after Enterprise's planes launched. And they had a rough idea where the Japanese fleet had last been sighted, but by the time they got there, it wasn't there, and they had to keep looking. And they waste a lot of fuel flying around their own carriers waiting for all the planes to get into the air. They wasted more fuel trying to find the Japanese. And by the time they got there with the main strike force, which was their torpedo planes, and they found the Japanese finally, they're really short of fuel. And the torpedo planes got there before the dive bombers. There were no fighter cover at all. The fighters were back with the main carriers. They had sorted first, and then being short of fuel, they had to go back and refuel while the strike planes finally got in the air. So it was complete a cluster, you know what, of an operation. It's a miracle it succeeded at all. Oddly enough, and fortunately for us, another miracle occurred. Not only did we find the Japanese, we found them at a time when their planes had just gotten back from Midway Island and were on the deck or down below refueling for a second strike on Midway. The best time to catch an air enemy is when their pants are down, and literally their pants were down as they're refueling their planes. So the torpedo planes come in with no air cover of their own, no fighter cover, and the Japanese fighter cover of zeros just is all over them like a duck on a June bug. And not a single torpedo plane gets through. Not a single torpedo is launched against these ships. All of them are shot down. It's a complete unmitigated disaster. This all takes place somewhere around the time of 9/16. All 15 Devastator torpedo bombers are shot down. And that's the main thing you kill ships with, is torpedoes. The dive bombers, which were following in the next wave, are really meant to attack ground targets. They aren't meant for attacking ships necessarily. But that's all we had left at that point. Fortunately for us, they were coming in at 10,000 feet. These were initially the dive bombers from the Enterprise. And they looked down and they saw the Japanese fleet, and there were no zeros anywhere in the air around them. All the zeros were way down below where the torpedo planes were above the deck, shooting down the torpedo planes. So the torpedo planes acted, if nothing else, as a sacrificial lamb to draw the zeros, the Jap zeros, out of the way of the dive bombers, who at 9:20 or 10:25, initiate their attack on the Akagi, the biggest ship in the Japanese fleet, in fact, they're the carriers. And in fact, they're the flagship of Admiral Nagumo. What followed was what is called the five-minute miracle, the miracle of Midway. In that 5 minutes, that dive bomber strike from Enterprise and shortly thereafter, within seconds, arrived the Yorktown's dive bombers in what would appear to have been a perfectly coordinated attack, but was a complete accident, them arriving at the same time. they managed to fatally wound three of the four Japanese carriers. Kagi, Kaga, and Soryu were reduced to smoking ruin within 5 minutes. The bombs penetrated the deck. A single bomb from one of the Enterprise dive bombers took out the Akagi. Once it penetrated the deck and exploded, it set all those fuel lines being used to fuel the Japanese planes alight, and the whole thing became a tinderbox that exploded. And this went on with the other two carriers as well, the Soryu and the Kaga. The only Japanese aircraft carrier that wasn't hit was the Hiru, which counterattacked shortly thereafter and succeeded in finding the Yorktown and fatally wounding the Yorktown. We ended up scuttling the Yorktown 2 days later. But we ended up wiping out those three carriers, and the next day we found the Hiru and finished it off as well for a total of four Japanese carriers.
So that was a good play, as they say. That worked out real well for us. Barry, can I take a little break, take a quick break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Barry Jacobson about the Battle of Midway. And I think it's going to get real good now. It's going to get even better than what Barry has described so far. And so far, it's absolutely amazing, all the knowledge and all the history we're picking up from our friend Barry. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we're listening to a great recount of the Battle of Midway with our friend Barry Jacobson. Barry, take it away.
Okay, so the dive bombers returned, and everyone on board Enterprise and the Hornet were ready to pursue the Japanese. We knew they were wounded badly. They counterattacked against the Yorktown, crippling it, and eventually would cause it to be scuttled. But we hadn't found their main fleet yet, and we knew there were more ships out there. So if Bull Halsey had been in command, and Halsey was a very, if you excuse the word, ballsy commander, ballsy Halsey, no doubt we would have gone full steam ahead and we would have pursued and gone westward right towards the Japanese fleet. And we would have found Hiru a day earlier, certainly, but we also would have run into an ambush because Admiral Yamamoto, when he saw what had happened to his carriers that were in advance of his battleships, was sure the Americans were going to pursue. So he had his ships wait quietly a few hundred miles beyond his carriers and had the carriers pull back towards the battleships. And he set up a battleship line of seven battleships. These were the mightiest ships possibly in the world at this time, including the Yamato, the largest battleship ever built. Just give you an idea how much bigger it was than most ships. Just to talk about the guns. The biggest ship we ever built was the Iowa-class battleship, the Missouri, the New Jersey, you know, the Iowa, the Wisconsin. They had 16-inch guns. Now, the Yamato had a displacement of 20% more, in other words, it's 20% bigger, and its guns were 18-inch guns, even bigger than the biggest battleship we had. They would have torn the American aircraft carriers to pieces. The American aircraft carriers only had teakwood decks. They didn't have steel decks. A plunging shell would have taken out, you know, one salvo could have taken out an aircraft carrier, penetrating its decks down into the vitals. But Admiral Spruance was cautious. He wasn't Bull Halsey. In fact, Spruance wasn't even an aircraft carrier officer. He wasn't a flight officer. He was originally a battleship guy. And he was cautious of battleships. And while everybody on the aircraft carrier, his flagship, the Enterprise, was screaming for him to pursue, Spruance held back. And thus he didn't fall into the trap that Yamamoto was planning for him. The following day, Yamamoto realized the Americans weren't going to pursue. And he took his licks and turned around and went home. And the Battle of Midway was over. It was an incredibly costly battle for the Japanese. Not only did they lose four of their frontline aircraft carriers, they lost all those pilots that had been on board, their entire complement of pilots and planes. Again, the same veterans who have been responsible for the attack on Pearl Harbor. So you can think of Midway, you can think of it as our revenge against the guys who did that to us on December 7th, 1941.
What were the casualties, just a rough guess of the casualties on both sides, Barry? Do you know?
Yeah, we have good numbers on that. The Japanese lost the four carriers, plus they lost a heavy cruiser. They also had numerous ships damaged. Aircraft, they lost 248 aircraft.
Oh, wow.
And about 3,000 killed, 3,057 killed. On our side, by contrast, we lost one carrier and only had 150 aircraft destroyed for about 300 men killed. So we lost a little more than half the number of planes the Japanese did, but one-tenth as many casualties. So it was a decisive victory. In fact, it's called the Miracle of Midway because there's so many reasons it should have gone wrong. We wouldn't necessarily have broke the Japanese code. We should not have been able to catch them refueling their planes. We might not have even found them at sea once the battle began because, again, it's a big ocean out there. But all these factors combined to catch the Japanese exactly at the right time and right place. And with a mere, you know, two aircraft carriers for the planes, the Yorktown and the Enterprise's dive bombers, those ships alone, one bomb was what destroyed the Akagi, the flagship of the Japanese Navy.
Wow.
An amazing victory.
I was just going to say, how quickly did we realize that it was an amazing victory? I mean, did this take a few days for this to sink in? And I guess that's not the best analogy to use, but I mean, for this for us to realize that this turned out to be a good battle for us. How quickly did it take us to figure that out, Barry?
Almost immediately. By June 7th, mm-hmm. When the Yorktown finally went down, and Admiral Spruance called the battle off, he withdrew, decided not to pursue. We had sunk the Hiro. That was the final strike. And we knew the Japanese lost four carriers. We had a pretty good idea how many carriers they had. So we knew we gutted the combined fleet's main strike force. That was huge. From then on, the Japanese would be on the defensive. The next main battle will happen later that year, and that will be the first landing by American Marines on the island of Guadalcanal, which we'll be talking about in a future episode. But from then on, the Japanese are defending. They're not attacking. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, they didn't know they're beaten yet, and they stubbornly refused to surrender. It's notable that even in Okinawa, by 1945, in the summer of 1945, just before the atomic bomb has dropped, we're battling them on Okinawa, the Japanese would still not surrender. You know, in every island, Peleliu, Guadalcanal, Bougainville, Saipan, they'd rather commit suicide than surrender. Amazingly stubborn foes. You know, we're entertaining the Japanese prime minister today, and I'm struck by Donald Trump giving him a big hug when he got there. The two men seemed to be getting along famously. And the truth is, we've been good friends and allies of Japan since the war. But you would never know it because that had to be one of the most bitter wars in human history as far as just pure hatred.
Right. Yeah. Well, you would think that, you know, maybe not of these two men, but men of their age, their grandfathers were probably fighting in that war. I don't know if that was the case of these two men, but it's very likely that, you know, men of their age would have had their grandfathers fighting each other in the Pacific. So now what about here, Barry, back in the U.S.? Go ahead. I was going to ask you about back here, but go ahead and say whatever you're going to say.
Here's my last thought. My father was a kill gunner on a B-26 Liberator in the Pacific in World War II. He got there at the very end of World War II, got there in 45, mm-hmm. so he saw virtually no action. But he grew up through teenage, you know, years. His formative years were during the war. And to this day, my father is 87 years old. To this day, he still hates the Japanese. There just is no forgiveness there. I don't know if the Japanese men of his age feel the same way. Perhaps they do, but I just know that we never quite got over what they did to us at Pearl Harbor and the stubborn way they fought the war from then on and the bad way in which they treated our prisoners.
Well, I can understand those feelings. I mean, you can always be diplomatic and show up and shake hands at, you know, some ceremony at Pearl Harbor, but those feelings inside of the buddies that you lost and, you know, the horrific battles that you saw and some of these things that men in that war had to do. I mean, it would be tough to get over it and just, you know, do kumbaya, as they like to say these days. But back here in the United States, Barry, how quickly was the public aware of the fact that this had been a great victory for the United States?
Almost immediately. I mean, the word got back to President Roosevelt day by day what was going on. And the president got on to one of his, you know, his fireside chants and explained to the nation that we had won a great victory. I think it sunk in the United States much faster than it did Japan. I think the Japanese were kind of in a state of denial for years. Sure, they recognized they lost four carriers, but I don't think the Japanese realized just how irreplaceable those pilots, even more than the ships, the pilots were. You know, these are guys who fought in China, you know, before the war. Some probably fought against the Russians in that brief war in which they, you know, got their butt kicked, but still fought the Russians in 1939. But no, I think we realized quickly we won a great victory, and it was you know, highly celebrated in the United States. By the way, at the same time this was happening, just to give you an idea, some other things were going on. That same day, June 4th, when the battle begins, in Europe, another event happens of great significance. The German Reich Chancellor of Czechoslovakia, Hitler's right-hand man, and in fact the guy who came up with a final solution, the so-called euphemism for the genocide against the Jews, was a guy named Reinhard Heydrich. And many people thought Heydrich would be Hitler's successor if Hitler were to die. He wasn't directly in line. That would have been Goering, was the number two guy. But, you know, Heydrich was the hardcore Nazi. He was a member of the SS, and he was leader of the SD, the German intelligence. And he was the Nazi's Nazi. And he'd been put in charge of Czechoslovakia as what they call the Reichsfuhrer of Czechoslovakia. He was utterly detested by the Czechs. And he was murdered, assassinated, those terms. He was assassinated in what was called Operation Anthropoid on the same day Midway began by Czech patriots operating with the British OSS.
Interesting. At that time, Barry, how much news were we getting back home, or what war was getting the majority of the news, the war in Europe or the war in the Pacific? If you're a typical American, were you more likely to hear, which side were you more likely to hear?
More is going on in Europe. We're going to switch, the next episode we'll switch to Europe, and we'll start talking about, we'll actually backload a little bit because we're into 1942 in the Pacific. A lot have been going on in Europe that we miss, so we'll get back and we'll catch up with Rommel and the Africa Corps. But keep in mind, in 1942, the same exact month that this happened, June of 1942, some other things were going on. The second year of the Russian campaign is underway. The Germans have launched Case Blue, which we'll eventually lead to the Battle of Stalingrad, in which they're launching an all-out offensive in southern Russia, which is modern-day Ukraine. And in June of this month, very month, there was battles around Kharkov, in which von Paulus' 6th Army was helping to encircle and destroy Russians around Kharkov, clearing the way for a drive south towards Stalingrad. In Africa, Rommel's Africa Corps was launching another offensive. They had been many, many offensives, but there was battles around the so-called Gazala line near the town of Gazala in what's modern-day Libya. So a lot has been going on in Europe, and at this very time, Americans would have been watching at home on newsreels, because there wasn't television back then. You either got your news from the radio, paper, or when you went to the movies, there'd be these 10-minute newsreels that were sort of like the lead-off to any movie you went to see. And that's how you got your news. And so Americans would have seen newsreels of the battles in Europe that have been going on since 1939. And as opposed to what was going on in the Pacific, which was up until, except for the Doolittle Raid and the Battle of the Coral Sea, with just one bad, you know, news after another of Japanese taking this island or taking that island. Midway was the first really great victory America achieved in the entire war.
Let me ask you one last question. What movie would you recommend, what Hollywood movie would you recommend about the Battle of Midway?
Well, sadly, there's only been two that are worthwhile. One's a movie and one's a TV miniseries. The movie, of course, is called Midway and starred Charlton Heston as Admiral Spruance. Badly miscast, by the way. Spruance was not a big strapping guy like Charlton Heston. But that said, you know, it's not as good as the movie that it was the successor to, which is called Tora, 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 which is a really a terrific film about Pearl Harbor. But if you want to get a good idea, watch Pearl Harbor, watch Tora, 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 and then watch Midway. But the very best account of the entire war, period, from start to end, is actually found in a miniseries, actually two miniseries. These are based on the novels by Herman Wouk, and the first novel and the first miniseries made in the 1980s was called The Winds of War. And that leads you from the beginning of the war right through and up till Pearl Harbor. And then the second series, and the second book, in fact, is based on, is called War and Remembrance. And that has the best sequences of Midway. Just the entire narrative of the war is beautifully told with characters you can identify with, a couple of families throughout the war from all sides, both Pacific and the Atlantic theater. So if you really love World War II and you haven't seen War and Remembrance or its successor, its sequel, Winds of War and then War and Remembrance, go see them or go buy them on Amazon because they really are terrific.
Great. So next time, where do we pick it up?
Next time we're going to pick it up with Rommel the Desert Fox.
Great.
In
one of the great personalities, right?
He really was. He was one of the few, maybe the only, Axis general, both Japanese, Italian, or German, that was admired by his enemies, was admired by the Allies. In fact, during his life, Winston Churchill got up and made a speech saying we are facing a very gallant and skilled opponent in the Field Marshal Rommel in Africa. You don't usually hear complimentary words from the British about the Germans, but Rommel was a gentleman. He was a great warrior, a great general, and he had commanded a panzer division in the fall of France in 1940. His 7th Panzer Division had overrun Normandy during the German conquest of France. And in October of that year, 1940, he had been sent to North Africa with a small panzer corps, 3 divisions, to bolster Mussolini. Mussolini had ambitions to recreate a Roman Empire in northern Africa and along the Nile River down in Ethiopia, which he had conquered in the 1930s. And the British held Egypt, and in fighting between the British and the Italians in Libya, the Italians had gotten the worst of it and were on the verge of collapse. And Hitler said, well, I can't have that. So he had sent Rommel to bolster the collapsing Italian fortunes in North Africa. And what followed was literally legendary, and we'll talk about that next.
And we'll get into that next week. As always, Barry, thank you so much for your time, and have a wonderful weekend. And I'm already looking forward to our next show because I've always been a big fan of the Desert Fox, so I'm sure I'll pick up a few more things, as I always do, when you join us. Have a great weekend. You're absolutely great, and thank you for your time. And, man, I don't know how you memorize it all, how you learn it all. You must have an encyclopedic, as they say, encyclopedic mind. Is that what they call it? You must have that. You're just absolutely great. You're absolutely great.
Well, thank you very
much. Always
it's always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure being on your
show. Thank you so much, and have a good weekend until the next time we chat. We're going to take a little break. We'll come back. During the break, we're going to hear from my friend Carlos Geddes, and he's going to tell you about an activity that he's got coming up Saturday night.
This is Carlos Geddes, Harpist, and I would like to see you guys this Saturday night at Nola Brasserie Authentic Cajun and Creole Restaurant, located at 1201 Main Street, downtown Dallas. I'll be performing instrumental high-energy jazz at 7:30 until midnight. Also, make your reservation today at 469-872-1820.
This is an absolutely amazing show that Carlos puts every Saturday night at NOLA. We went there a couple of weekends ago. And if you're in the Dallas area and you're, within the Dallas area and you're looking for something to do Saturday night, I know a lot of couples are probably going to go out Saturday night for Valentine's Day. You're going to love the food and you're going to love his music. So check it out. Check it out at NOLA, N-O-L-A. You can just Google it, N-O-L-A, Dallas, Texas, and you'll get the address. It's downtown Dallas. And one good thing about the fact that it's Saturday night, the parking is great. There's no problem parking. They're parking inside the building. So there's no problem parking whatsoever, and you're going to have a heck of a good time, great music, and lots of good entertainment. Again, my thanks to Barry Jacobson for the Battle of Midway, always very informative when we talk to Barry, and we're going to do another show next week. We'll get back to the story of World War II. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.